May it please the court, I'm Spencer Dennison. My registration number is 976, and I'm appearing on behalf of Forest Oil Corporation and OmniMax Petroleum, Inc., the appellants here. The main issue on this appeal is the meaning of the term completion, or completion of a well, in this continuous drilling clause, which said that no more than 180 days would elapse between the completion or abandonment of one well and the beginning of operations of another well. The question is, when is a well, a gas well here, completed so as to start the 180-day period running? The completion phrase first appears in paragraph one of these, and the plaintiffs admit that in that phrase it meant that each well had to be finished or ready to produce gas before the 180 days would start to run. But they introduced parole evidence to the fact that when they negotiated the addendum that became Exhibit A to this lease, that they orally agreed with the lessee to change the meaning, give the words completion a different meaning, even though the words are exactly the same. They claim that different meaning is what continues to control today, not the words in the lease. Second issue in the case is the meaning of the words continuously prosecuted in the lead-in part of the clause that says the lease shall not terminate so long as drilling or reworking operations are being continuously prosecuted, if not more than the 180 days and so forth. Those are the two contract issues I would like to talk about, to each of them in a little bit more detail, and then time permitting we'll turn to the damages issues and the attorney fee issues in the case. As to the meaning of completion of a well, I think the discussion needs to start with the ambiguous test under Colorado law. And I think the usually is seen as a two-part test in which the court considers the agreement in question, the evidence, and the authorities that are offered to show that the term is ambiguous, and then makes a judgment as to whether the words are, on their face, reasonably susceptible to more than one meaning, reasonably susceptible to each of the competing interpretations. In that analysis, the words have to be given their plain and ordinary meaning, their, I guess what I think of as their Webster's Dictionary meaning, and all the provisions in the agreement need to be considered. If the words on their face does not reasonably support the two competing interpretations,
if I could just interrupt you there for just 1 minute, I want to understand what it is that you want us to do. I mean, on the one hand, you're telling us that we're to look at the contract itself, at the language at issue itself, but then in the same breath, in your brief, you point us to the Bledsoe's testimony about their understanding of what completion of a well meant. Which do you want us to do? Do you want us to just look at the contract, or do you want us to consider their testimony as well? I'm not sure that we should do both.
Right. Well, Judge, I think you have to start with the words on their face. And the language and the face, and make a judgment, as I said, as to whether the words on their face are reasonably susceptible to the two competing interpretations. I think our law is, though, that you can consider the extrinsic evidence on that issue. I mean, and I think we you know, years ago we had the Four Corners Doctrine and so forth, but I think we've moved beyond that, and it is appropriate to consider the extrinsic evidence as to whether it's reasonably susceptible to more than one interpretation. I think you start with the language, but I think you can then go beyond that.
Pardon me, Mr. Dennison, if I may ask a follow-up question, please.
Sure.
If so, if we're satisfied, hypothetically, that the language of the document is clear, we don't need to go to the testimony of anyone, is that correct?
I think that's right, Judge. I mean, I think, and we didn't in this case argue about evidentiary matters, what comes in or doesn't come in. We basically, Judge Hoyer said, Larry, you want to hear everything. So we said, okay, that's the way it'll be. But yes, I would agree. If you reach a conclusion based on the language, you don't need to get to sorting out the details on the extrinsic evidence and so forth.
Mr. Dennison, paragraph 13 of the lease says that all express or implied covenants in this lease shall be subject to all federal and state laws, executive orders, rules, or regulations. And this lease shall not be terminated or in whole or in part, nor lessee held liable in damages for failure to comply therewith. The Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, by regulation, says a gas well shall be considered completed when the well is capable of producing gas through wellhead equipment from the ultimate producing zone after the production string has been run.
Would you agree that
in light of that regulation and the lease, completion is not ambiguous, it's a clear term, and it's been defined?
Judge, I agree completion is not ambiguous. And I think that we have argued that the regulatory definition in the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission regs is evidence here of the what I refer to as the sort of the specialized meaning given to the term in the industry. I don't think, to be candid with the court, I haven't really looked at that issue as to the effect of paragraph 13 on this thing. I don't think that this is a case in which we would contend that that the regulatory definition is directly applicable here. But I think it is evidence of the specialized meaning given to that term in the industry. If I could, the Webster's defines the word, though, complete or completion to mean that a process or course of action has to be finished or brought to an end for it to be completed. And our argument is, as is obvious, that completion necessarily refers to the point where a well is completed. I mean, completed in fact. A hole has to be drilled in the ground. You've got to put pipe in it. You've got to do a bunch of operations and so forth to it. You have to put equipment on the top to control it. Until that occurs, the well is not in fact completed. And that's what we say the term means. We also think, and the second point here is on the completion issue, is that any question as to the meaning about the words themselves was really resolved by Mr. Bledsoe's testimony. His testimony was unequivocal. He admitted that the words completion in the phrase, completion or abandonment of one well and so forth, in paragraph one of the lease, meant that a well had to be finished or ready to produce gas for it to be completed. That's what he said. There wasn't any question about it. But even though he knew that was the meaning, he claimed that for purposes of this lease, that the parties agreed to something different. They agreed to change the meaning. He didn't say the words meant something else. He said they agreed to something else. But the words are exactly the same, word for word. And we say this is a classic case for application of the parole evidence rule. You can't have the lease saying one thing on its face and the plaintiffs here saying, oh, no, we agreed to something else. The parole evidence cannot be used to change that meaning. I guess the third point I'd make on the completion issue is that Forest Oil offered evidence as to the specialized meaning in the industry. I mean, the regs, their definitions from industry dictionaries, their case law treatises, and so forth. The parties agree that kind of evidence as to specialized meaning in the industry, is appropriate for the court to consider on the issue of whether it's ambiguous and I think on the issue of interpreting it. We showed that the term has an accepted general meaning in the industry. It's the same as the plain meaning. Several of those authorities were general in nature. Some were specifically addressed to this context. I mean, this kind of a provision that says you got to complete one well before you start the next one. I mean, that's a specific kind of a context, and our argument is you got to have the first one finished before you start on to the next one. That's the holding in the old Michigan case that we cite, Howard against Hughes. That test is recognized, discussed in the Oklahoma case. That's the Edwards case. It's discussed in Professor Kuntz's treatise. And the basic rationale for those cases and so forth is you got to get the first well finished before you get to the second one, because the operator, the guy who's out there looking for oil and gas, he wants to have the information that comes from that first well available so that he knows whether to go ahead with the second one or not. Where to drill the second one? Is the first one a good one or a bad one? I mean, you need to know that before you go to the next next well. The only other meaning for the term completion that's recognized in the cases or authorities is just the simply the drilling of the borehole. And in the Michigan case, Howard against Hughes, they refer to that as drilling in the well, if you will. That meaning has been applied in the context of drilling contracts, contracts with a driller whose only obligation is to go out there and drill a hole, not to drill a well, but just drill a hole to a total depth level. But that meaning has been specifically rejected in the cases and in the general authorities. This isn't a case in which one party, the Bledsoes, came in and said that there's some specialized meaning, a terminology that's accepted in the industry that's different than the plain meaning. That isn't this case. I mean, there was no evidence from their side that it was commonly understood that a well only had to be drilled and then cased and then the rig released. That's their interpretation. There's no evidence that was an interpretation that is specially recognized in the industry. Instead, in an effort to get around Mr. Bledsoe's admission and the plain meaning, the Bledsoes came in with expert testimony from Professor Kramer, who testified that completion can have different meanings in different contexts, can have a range of meanings depending on the context. He basically said it could mean anything. It could mean any number of things. And he agreed with me on cross-exam that completion has the general meaning that we say it does. And his manual, I mean, the manual, the Williams and Myers manual on oil and gas terms, describes that very same general meaning that we say it has. But he said that meaning was so general, so generic, that it's really meaningless, that the court should disregard it. And the court should go to looking to the extrinsic evidence to try to figure out what the parties had intended. There are two main problems with that approach. Very briefly, were there two? I mean, to say that completion can have different meanings, that's really to beg the question. I mean, the question is, what does the term mean in this context? And Professor Kramer did not offer any evidence on that point. He did not come in and say the general or commonly understood meaning of the term that a well merely has to be drilled down and then cased and then the rig release. That was not his testimony. Second, and perhaps more important, we of course believe that there is an industry specialized meaning of the term. It's the same as the plain meaning. But if there isn't, in our view, the court needed to default back to the plain meaning of the term. And the plain meaning would then be subject to the reasonably susceptible to more than one interpretation. If I could, let me turn to the second contract issue, the continuously prosecuted issue. The continuously prosecuted phrase, appears in the sort of leading part of the clause. And again, the phrase was copied over from paragraph one of the lease. And it said that the lease would not terminate so long as the drilling and reworking operations were continuously prosecuted. But in paragraph one, it had a little phrase in there that said, an operation shall be considered to be continuously prosecuted if not more than the 180 days and so forth shall run. That phrase was left out. The words there, operation shall be considered to be continuously prosecuted. That's why we have an issue here. The analysis is not quite the same as with respect to the completion issue, but the problem is not the generally or the plain meaning of the words. It's the problem of taking the words, the continuously prosecuted words, in the context of the other provisions in the lease. It could have the same meaning as it does in paragraph one. It's qualified by the 180 days. Or if you just take the two words, continuously prosecuted by themselves, taken in isolation, you don't look to the 180 days, then hypothetically you could say, well, they just mean you've got to be drilling continuously and so forth. We say that the court's interpretation here, continuously prosecuted, is not reasonably susceptible to the interpretation that the court placed on it. The court's view was it just meant we had to be out there drilling a well every day of the week. 5 days a week was his interpretation. And further, we would say here on this issue that in any event, there is no extrinsic evidence in the record that supports the trial court's interpretation that the continuously prosecuted words imposed a second affirmative obligation. I want to try to reserve a few minutes here to respond to Mr. Barber's arguments and so forth, and I'm about down to 4 minutes left. So I think I would just make 2 points, and 3 points on the continuously prosecuted issue. It's got to be qualified by the 180 days. I mean, Mr. Bledsoe said the 180-day part of the phrase was the minimum. That was the, in his words, farthest out, the less he could go and still be in compliance with the lease. There's no extrinsic evidence, no testimony, no extrinsic evidence to support the interpretation that this imposed a second obligation to be drilling a well every day of the week. And finally, I mean, the one argument which the court relied on, the argument that there wasn't any reason to put that continuously prosecuted phrase in Exhibit A unless the intent was to change its meaning, that argument, I think we addressed this in our brief, that argument is just wrong. I mean, the clause, the phrase is in there in Exhibit A so as to give the lessee the right to extend the lease by drilling in that circumstance. It's different than the drilling over situation which is addressed in paragraph 1 in the form part of the lease. If I may, I'll reserve the remaining time. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I have to say your low-key facade out here had me walking around the building a couple of times. I was almost late getting here, but I somehow managed to make it.
Not myself.
Yeah. I also wanted to acknowledge that two of the plaintiffs are here today, Sandra Bowman and Grant Bledsoe. May it please the court, counsel, I represent a group of plaintiffs, and they're individuals and their LLPs and their family corporations that own about 61,000 acres of property in eastern Colorado, primarily in Yuma County. The family was approached, and I call it the family, it's the Bledsoe family, all of these businesses and entities are within the family. The family was approached by Mr. Champion in 2001 to lease the entire 61,000 acres. That I think is borne out by the record, was an extraordinarily large parcel of property. The 61,000 acres discusses the surface extent of the property, and there was about 41,000 what we call net mineral acres underneath that 61,000, referring to the fact that the plaintiffs don't own 100% of all the minerals under the 61,000. So roughly 41,000 net mineral acres. When Mr. Champion approached the plaintiffs, he knew that they hadn't really leased this property, even though it was a prospective area. He was told by the plaintiffs that they were really not interested in leasing their property under one large lease. They preferred smaller 640-acre leases because they had heard horror stories about oil companies going in and drilling wells and sort of sitting on the well, and it would be capable of producing. They might not even frack it. And that one well would be enough to hold the property and the entire lease, basically, as long as that well was capable of producing or was producing. So the parties, and Judge Hoyer recognized this, undertook an extensive amendment of what is the standard oil and gas lease. The standard oil and gas lease contains a habendum clause that says the lease continues for a given period, which is called the primary term, and so long thereafter as oil and gas is produced in paying quantities. The parties in Exhibit A basically replaced that provision. They said, notwithstanding anything in this lease, the new habendum clause in Exhibit A applies. And with
Mr. Barber,
yes, sir.
With regard to that, how is this significant amendment manifested in the language of Exhibit A? Because the language looks to be pretty much the same as the language in paragraph one.
Well, the habendum clause that's in the form of the lease says that the lease continues so long as there is production or a well capable of producing. All right, that's the only requirement in the original habendum clause. Exhibit A says the lease will terminate automatically after the 5 years, except for the 640-acre governmental sections where there is such a producing well. So you can imagine the first major change is that instead of having one well holding 61,000 acres, it only holds 640 acres. That's the first change. The second change that, actually the next two changes that are fundamental is that normally under the habendum clause, as it's written in the form lease, there is no obligation to continuously drill and operate additional wells. The Exhibit A clause, as Judge Hoyer recognized, imposed additional requirements that said the oil companies had to continuously drill or rework and drill a new well at the very least within 180 days. Those aren't found in the habendum clause. What the habendum clause has is something called a drilling over provision. And that drilling over provision, only refers to the situation where a well is started before the end of the primary term, the lessee here or Forest or Houston Exploration would be given the opportunity to complete that well and take it on to production in paying quantities. But once it did that, the habendum clause under the form is satisfied. What Exhibit A did was to impose the requirement, not only do you have to have wells producing in commercial quantities at the end of the lease, it only holds the 640 for that well, and there is a continuous drilling requirement or the rest of the acreage is lost, it's terminated.
Pardon me for interrupting if I may, Mr. Barber, but I've got to be honest with you that I'm a little bit confused by what you've just said.
Okay.
In looking at the Exhibit A language, it strikes me that we have the following phrase. If not more than 180 days shall lapse between the completion or abandonment of one well and the beginning of operations for the drilling of another well. If indeed the parties wished to focus on drilling as the active component of this, it would strike me that that language should read, not more than 180 days shall lapse between the end of drilling of one well or the completion of drilling of one well and the beginning of operations for the drilling of another well. But yet that's not what it says. We have the completion or abandonment of one well language instead. So can you help me with that?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The clause that you pointed to actually has two parts to it, and you just focused on the second part.
I have a question about the first part in a minute.
That clause says this lease shall not terminate, so the premise is that the lease terminates unless either drilling or reworking operations are being continuously prosecuted. That's one. And then not more than 180 days between the completion of one well and the beginning of another. So I think the way that language is written, it sets up two distinct clauses that must be complied with in order for the lease to continue. And remember, we're talking about a very large lease, and the parties specifically discussed this language and the Bledsoe's concern that one well or a meager output of wells would not hold the entire property, you know, for so long as there was any production on the property.
Pardon me for interrupting you again, but you've implicated my next question. I'll ask that now and then let you answer the whole thing. It appears to me that the continuously prosecuted language is defined now by the phrase, if not more than 180 days. I understand that Judge Hoyer inserted an and in there in his order, but I see no and. And it appears to me that what the purpose of the clause, if not more than 180 days, et cetera, is to define the term continuously prosecuted. Now, if you'd go ahead and answer my first question and that question together, I'd appreciate it, and then I'll shut up.
All right, please, that's what we're here for. We're here for oral argument. We're here to answer your questions. The clause that is in this Exhibit A basically prevents the lease from terminating, and it has that first component that says as long as drilling or reworking operations are continuously prosecuted. First of all, you have to think of drilling or reworking operations continuously prosecuted. So what does that mean? Does that mean that you can go out and rework a well one day and wait another 179 days before you drill another well? That's not what that language says, and it's certainly not what the parties discussed when they negotiated the agreement. The idea was that at the end of the primary term, the lessee would be continuously drilling or reworking wells, and at that point there were 144 wells out there, so there were plenty of opportunities to rework wells as well as to drill new ones. But at the very least, a new well also had to be drilled every 180 days. This was a way that the parties understood that they could basically develop the lease in a sped-up basis as opposed to just having one well every 180 days. I think that was absolutely the interpretation that the parties gave to it. And let me get to the definition of completion, because that maybe goes to your question too. The definition of completion Judge Hoyer determined was ambiguous. And under the modified Four Corners rule, I'll call it, he was allowed to take parole testimony on what that term meant in the oil and gas industry, because it is a term of art in the oil and gas industry. We cite in our brief that the authorities are absolutely in concurrence with Judge Hoyer that it is not an unambiguous term. The Darman Treatise says completion of a well can occur depending on the party's intent from the time the well is drilled to total depth, cased, and tested, all the way to the time where you can turn on a valve to produce the well. Professor Kramer in his Williams Treatise says that it has no, the term completion of a well has no specific meaning as a general matter. Professor Koontz, another treatise on oil and gas law, says that it is inherently ambiguous term because it can be used differently under different contracts and by parties to even oil and gas leases. Mr. Jones, the expert who appeared for the defendants in this case, admitted that it is not a term, completion is not a term that's defined for purposes of oil and gas leases. Mr. Champion, under him, who was the original lessee, under cross-examination, admitted that he probably told the Bledsoes that completion meant the time when the well reached total depth and was tested and cased. So Judge Hoyer conditionally admitted that evidence, and I think properly found that the term completion is not unambiguous. It can have different meanings, and the parties here have negotiated that very meaning.
Mr. Barber, given that you're advocating, I guess, a process, you know, the fact that completion can involve a process, not just one specific point in time, why shouldn't we conclude that at the very least the parties should have been had an opportunity to get to the fracturing phase? Because just because they found out during drilling that there is something down there, maybe they didn't know whether or not it'd be in paying quantities. So why shouldn't we set the fracture date as the completion date?
That was one of the alternatives offered by the witnesses, that fracturing was possibly the completion date, drilling to total depth could be the completion date, turning the valve could be a completion date, all depending on the intent of the parties. But here, that really goes to the heart of what I started out talking about, which is that this was an enormous lease. And the Bledsoes were expressed their concern that neighbors next door had had wells drilled, cased, and logged, and the oil company went away for 6 months. Then they come back and fracture the well. And so instead of having a well every 180 days, if you define completion by when the rig was released, you might have a well every year and a half if you use fracturing as the date when the 180 days started to run.
But if the Bledsoes had wanted the date that total depth was reached, why didn't they just say, you know, when total depth is reached as opposed to when completion?
I think, Your Honor, that goes to the question of, or it goes to the issue and the fact that completion is ambiguous. And so they talked about what that meant. And there was testimony from Ms. Bowman, from Mr. Bledsoe, and even Mr. Champion, that they went over that. Because remember, in this lease, they went from requiring a new well every 90 days to a well every 180 days. And they had to have a fixed point in time when that 180 days would start to run. And if it was the fracking time, that was totally in the control of the oil company. Whereas when a well is drilled out at this field, and this is what the evidence showed, the well is drilled, it is cemented, it's cased, the rig goes away. That was like a metronome. That's how the process worked. And it didn't depend on whether a service company was available to come in and frack a well, or a pipeline was available so that you could just turn the well to production. All of those things would delay the quote completion, if that is what the definition, if the definition of the defendants is accepted. And it would turn it into a very open question as to when the next well had to occur. And I think this is a very important point, because if you look at the records in this case, there were files maintained by Houston Exploration, which was the predecessor to Forest, which had a critical dates obligation, a critical dates deadline, because they knew that they had these provisions in there. They knew that they had to continuously drill or rework, and they had to do a well every 180 days. And when they put in their calendar of when the next well was due, the evidence was that they used the rig release date to time the 180 days. They didn't use the frack date. They didn't use the date of first production. So the party's own interpretation before a dispute occurred in this case is consistent with what the Bledsoe's testimony was, and also with what the authorities say, that it basically should be interpreted in light of the party's intent, because it's not a clear and unambiguous factor. But I want to move off of that for just a moment, if I could move back to the continuous drilling or reworking. If you compare the language in the habendum clause, which I think we can all agree was modified substantially, it doesn't say, it doesn't have any continuous drilling or reworking obligation in it. You're not required under the initial 5-year term of the lease to do anything. So requiring continuous drilling or reworking was a new concept in the secondary term. Forest paid a substantial bonus, excuse me, Mr. Champion paid a substantial bonus at the beginning of the lease, and he didn't have to drill any more wells for the first 5 years. But at the end of the 5 years, the idea was you couldn't just sit on this lease. And what the parties did was they inserted these requirements, which are really development requirements, in the lease. So if there are no more questions about that, I think I'd like to move on to one other point that I'd like to that we raised in our appeal, and that was whether the implied obligations of the lease were overcome by what was called these drilling obligations. And the implied obligation in every oil and gas lease under the Davis versus Kramer case is that there will be new wells drilled and the exploration of the property under the prudent operator standard. Here we had evidence that less than a third of the property had been explored by the time this lease was terminated, and the forest had essentially moved all of its operations off the lease. Recall that, or you may not recall, but in the evidence it showed that in the fall of 2007, shortly after Forest took over this lease, we're in the secondary term, where they're supposed to be drilling and reworking constantly, they went two-thirds of that fall without either drilling or reworking on the property. So the question is that a reasonable and prudent thing to do as a reasonable and prudent operator? We say that the lease did not supplant the reasonable operator standard. We say that it may have sped up the requirements, but it didn't supplant that. And as a matter of law, the judge said it did. So I think that's a question that your honors can decide as a matter of law. And then finally, another open question in this jurisdiction that is raised by this case is, what does the statute that requires a release of a lease mean in terms of the kinds of damages that a party can obtain when a lease is forfeited or terminated and that oil company refuses to release the lease? And the language is simply that the lessor of the property may recover any damages that the evidence supports if a lessee neglects or refuses to release the lease. Judge Hoyer held that as a matter of law, we'll treat this like a slander of title claim, where you have to prove special damages. We don't think the legislature's wording is susceptible to Judge Hoyer's interpretation. So that's an issue we raise on our appeal. I have a minute and a half. I'd like to reserve it if I could. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Dennison and Marks, would you please comment upon Mr. Barber's observation that the drilling logs establish a 180-day line from the release date as opposed to a date when wells were producing, capable of producing gas?
I'm not sure I understand the court's point. I mean, let me try to try to respond, and then maybe you can set me straight here. I think Mr. Barber was saying that you can't have the 180 days start at the point where the well is actually completed. I mean, when it's been cased and perforated and fracked and so forth, because that date may get strung out. And the reason that isn't a problem is because the operator wants to get the well completed as quickly as he can. He wants to get the thing producing so he can start selling gas and make money. That's in the royalty owner's best interest as well. And I think the operator has an obligation of due diligence and so forth. He's got to get through that process. And if I don't think that I think it's sort of a straw man argument. I don't think that the operator can just go in and drill a well, case it, and move out and let it go. I mean, is that the question, Your Honor? Am I being responsive?
Well, you are in a tangent sort of way. My understanding of his comment was that, hey, the predecessor sort of set the idea of what completion was under the drilling logs, and those drilling logs are some evidence that it considered completion to be the date that the well was cased.
Okay, I'm sorry, I am on a tangent. You're talking about Exhibit 48, this Houston exploration spreadsheet, and we laid out the facts on that. I mean, the superintendent of the land department set the thing up. It called for a rig release date and a completion date. When they started keeping the records, he kept them right. He had the rig release date, he had the completion date down, and the completion date was the frack date or later. Then a second landman came in and took over, and he just shortcut the thing. And it was a crib sheet. This is not the well log. And the point I'm trying to make is that the official record, what Houston and Forrest call their well view reports or well master reports, those reports show when the completion process started. It would start when they put the casing down. It showed when the completion work was finished, and that was when the well was fracked and the frack job was allowed to flow out, and they started then the hookup process. That's where they kept those formal records in those logs, not in the Exhibit 48 spreadsheet. That thing was just a crib sheet. And I guess to put it in context, Judge, I think that That crib sheet is not evidence. It is evidence, certainly. It's not evidence of what the parties did or thought back in 2001, because these were different people. And it's not really evidence, I don't believe, of a specialized industry meaning. And it's certainly not evidence as to the plain meaning of the word completion in the lease.
I'll pick up with the point that Mr. Dennison just left off with. These documents, this Exhibit 48, was not a, quote, crib sheet. It was a document entitled Critical Obligation Dates for the Bledsoe lease, custom tailored to make sure that the oil company met all of the dates that it had to meet under this lease. The dates that were used to determine when the next well had to be drilled under that document authored by the oil company was the date of rig release. So it is totally consistent with what the Bledsoe's interpretation was. And I think that gets back to the fact that there can be different interpretations of the word completion. And Dennison argues that, well, the oil companies and the Bledsoe's had the same interest. Gee, the oil companies would want to get out there and complete the well and turn it to production. Maybe, maybe not. If it's not a very good well, they might not want to turn it to production. If they turn it to production, under their theory of completion, the 180-day clock starts. And they might not have the budget to drill another well in that 180 days. So while there is occasionally and sometimes a unity of interest between the lessor and the lessee, oftentimes there is not. And that's why you have many implied as well as express obligations. Thank you.
Thanks to Mr. Dennison and Mr. Broberg. The court appreciates counsel's excellent arguments. They were helpful to us today. We appreciate that. That completes the docket for today. This case will be considered and a formal opinion will issue in due course that is deemed submitted at this point.